Welcome to Rexomatic Records with your hosts, Rex Anderson, Tom Hughes, and Andy Kern. This is a show dedicated to pretty much anything we want to talk about.
Joining us today is Steve Sutherland from Seattle, Washington. Steve is a singer-songwriter who contributed several songs and co-wrote several songs for the first Big For His Age album. This time around, he co-wrote and contributed his musical talents to the song She Said, He Said.
Me blue, and he said, we'll paint the walls something new. She said, lost the strength to carry on. Then he said, let's look one more day beyond.
Welcome to Rexomatic Records podcast, Steve Sutherland. I'm going to start by introducing Tom Hughes and Andy Kern, who are both on the line. Hey, guys.
Hello. This is Tom.
This is Andy. Hello, everybody.
So, Steve, today we just want to visit with you a little bit about your music, your songwriting, and a little bit about your contribution to the Big For His Age 2 album. So you and I have known each other for many, many years, and I've told both Andy and Tom about some of our history and having a drum kit up in your attic on a street downtown Kansas City many, many years ago. But I'm going to just turn it over to Tom to kind of get us started, and he'll kind of ask you some questions about your musical background, and then Andy will jump in from time to time when we talk about some of the technical side of recording for some of the contributions you made to the record. So, Tom, let me turn it over to you and have you get started.
Okay, thanks. Hi, Steve. How have you been? I haven't seen you in quite a while.
Yeah, it's been a long time. Yeah,
up in Shaky Town up there.
That's right.
One thing I'm always curious about is, when someone who plays an instrument first picked it up.
Yeah. So I started on ukulele, actually, when I was 8 years old. My dad had a ukulele that he bought when he was eight in 1931. I wish I had that uke, because I'm pretty sure it was a Martin, one of the early Martin ukes. Mm-hmm. But he also had a book by Arthur Godfrey, and it was called, I think it was called You Can Play the Uke or something like that. And
right.
So I taught myself uke when I was really young, and, you know, loved being able to play music right away, because, you know, ukulele is such an accessible instrument for kids, really. And, you know, you get really successful quickly. Like, you can play folk songs really fast, and really enjoyed that. We always camped and sung around the campfire a lot, so I always took that with me, and we'd play that as family. But when I was 12, I started to get interested in guitar. My brother had bought a really cheap guitar, and I started to noodle around with that, extending the ukulele. And I think my parents gave me 4 guitar lessons down at some strip mall in the late 60s. And, you know, right from that point, I sort of self-taught by listening to records, mostly, you know, like John Denver taught me guitar, and Neil Diamond. And so I think then at the same time, I was really interested in singer-songwriters, because pop music kind of went by me. I actually kind of missed the Beatles, actually, until later in life, but which are great songwriters, but I just missed them completely. And I really got latched on to singer-songwriters and lyric content. I would pore over album covers that I would buy and then read the lyrics excessively. And I think I really enjoyed that process, and learning songs off the record. That was my big deal. Mm-hmm. And then in college, Rex would remember this, I had a partner that we played music together, and we play in little coffee shops and stuff. And we would try to do covers, but we'd always stay away from trying to be like the the record, we find another way to do the song, interpret it in some other way. And I really like that process of playing a song but finding a new way to do it, whether it was a rock song turning to acoustic or a folk song, and you know, work on a different. My partner could play harmonica well, and it was a really great bluegrass guitarist, so we take folk songs kind of into that range or into blues or something. So that's kind of how I started, you know, through the 70s. And, you know, kept playing. I probably touch a guitar every single day since I was 12. So it's one of the things.
Curious about in your answer, these Beatles that you referred to, did they ever wind up doing anything? Were they?
Yeah, I think they got bigger later. I think people,
Okay, I just don't know them. I had a similar experience. I got the same guitar, I think, that everyone got when they were a kid. It was a guitar that was sold by Sears.
Yeah, Silvertone.
Yeah, and it was the same guitar that Muddy Waters and all the blues players started out on, except they followed through with it, and I took two lessons and then disappeared on my bicycle for 4 weeks so I wouldn't have to take another one.
Right.
And didn't pick up guitar again until a number of years later. So your story is pretty inspiring for younger people and even people like me who are just probably minutes away from death.
Yes, right. I still actually have a friend of mine about 20 years ago had a Silvertone in his closet. And he said, I didn't touch this since I was, he's my age. He touched it when he was like 4 or 5 or something. And he gave it to me. So I have a really beautiful Silvertone that's almost vintage. You know, it's like almost like out of the box. And I play that continuously. It's right next to my bed.
I have my original guitar. It's got some cracks in it, and I'm in the process of repairing
it. Oh, cool.
Just for the sake of bringing back some more horrific memories from the past.
Yeah.
So you were doing mostly covers in with your partner. When did you but you sound like you were very intrigued by lyricists.
Yeah.
When did you first start to write your own lyrics?
I think, you know, there's a little notebook that I have downstairs somewhere that I probably, when I was 15 or 16, I started to scribble like a lot of people do in notebooks, as if you're going to come up with the next big hit or something. But really in earnest, when I got out of college, I think I started to write songs, full songs, and worked out the chords and then the arrangement. And I think, Rex, you probably remember, we bought that little Tascam 4-track. I love that thing.
This might be a good point for Andy to jump in. Andy, when Steve was living in Kansas City and I was in Lawrence, Kansas, we'd get together and play with a couple other musicians. And that led us to kind of experiment. Of course, Steve was pretty unique at that time because he had something called a job.
And, that's right.
And because of that job, he was actually able to buy things. And one of the things he bought was one of the original Tascam 4-track recorders. So, Andy, do you remember those things on the cassette 4-tracks?
Yeah. Does anybody remember having one of the TIAC 4-track reel-to-reels, or was I just, did I just go, I think that was before the cassette players.
That's right.
The cassette came out. So the cassettes were quite a revolution because they really brought it down to where anybody, you know, pretty casually could do it. And of course, everybody remembers, trying to bounce down or accidentally recording over something that you just did, realizing you forgot to make a switch change.
I remember we would you would have to lay it out, and the 4-tracks like got covered really fast by the like a rhythm guitar just to sort of set it up, and maybe a little bit of a click or something, and then you had to bounce down. I think you'd get a total of like 10 tracks by bouncing down until you're literally bouncing a bounce track. And we had so much fun sort of working out, okay, what are the 10 tracks we can do and then how you can mix it down to a stereo mix, which was just a real challenge, you know.
But, yeah, yeah. Did you guys remember doing the? I kind of had a rule like, okay, I got this song. I'm probably going to have to do it twice because it's going to take me one time to figure out what I want to put on there,
yeah.
and then another time to go through and just put the track so I don't end up with a bunch of noise at the end.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the songs that we recorded this week back in the early 80s in Steve's house was a song called She's So Tan. And many years later, that ended up on the first Big for His Age album.
That's right.
And we had quite a few harmonies on that. But I think that's, at least for me, was one of the most enjoyable parts of those sessions was layering in and layering up the harmonies.
Yeah, that's right.
On some of those songs.
That was, yeah, really, you could do a lot with that. And it's amazing that that machine was so affordable. You know, obviously 1982 or something, it was over $300, I think. Maybe it was $400. But at the time, single, had a salary, was an engineer. And so what the heck, right? And it was, you dive into it. But what a great little machine to kind of get into the idea of you know, those are more like about capturing a performance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then you jump to today, not to go too fast here, but now with DAW, with the digital, you know, audio workstation, it's more about almost creating a performance out of audio clips as opposed to, you know, capturing a performance. I know you guys probably in the studio did a lot of live capture, but a lot of times it's, you know, it's me working by myself, and it's all about sort of capturing versus sort of just recording. And you're with that little TAC, you're sort of just in the scramble mode all the time trying to make it clean enough. So what a great little machine.
Well, you might find this hard to believe, but you live in a town with, as I remember, had some pretty good guitar and equipment shops.
Yeah.
But those Tascam, older Tascam machines, the 4-tracks and the 8-track cassette ones are very difficult to find.
Yeah.
And when you find one, they're kind of expensive.
Mm-hmm.
People are still using them and recording them.
Yeah.
So now that we start thinking about moving forward to digital audio workstations and the thousands and thousands of tracks that we do every time we try to make a recording, let's talk a little bit about the song on the new album called She Said, He Said, which Steve and I co-wrote a few years back. Maybe, Steve, it'd be helpful just to kind of go through the process, at least from your perspective, how you saw it develop this time.
Yeah.
Obviously, we had done a demo on it a couple of years ago. But we kind of started from scratch again, and you started with a new demo of the song. Maybe go through that process a little bit.
Right. So, you know, I had the idea of it. I think I came down to visit you guys, you know, gosh, 15 years ago, and had the little kernel of an idea of basically the clueless guy that's not getting the communication and how it's sort of ripping apart this relationship. And then you and I sat just with an acoustic and flushed it out, and I think I brought it back and finished it back here, and then I recorded, and I don't remember what, I think I had a little Fostex digital recorder at the time, and recorded just an acoustic version, which, that's how the song started, was kind of a Johnny Cash sort of single guitar and a voice, and then, you know, after we started talking about maybe flushing it out and further, I took it and went towards kind of the, I don't know, kind of grew to become more Everly Brothers or something like that. And it sort of expanded. And I think with the digital workstation for me, when I start working, once I have a sort of a palette, or at least actually a canvas that has been sort of colored a little bit, then you start seeing things, you start hearing things. Background vocals, a guitar lick that kind of flushes it out or pushes forward. And that's kind of how I work now, is I get an idea, I begin to get it into the workstation, and then you start hearing another drum maybe, you know, a section that needs to be flushed out with a keyboard or something. And so that's what that demo then that I gave to you guys was basically a full-blown production of that song with backing vocals and guitars and It sort of just grows organically, but the workstation, the digital workstation for me just allows that very extremely liquid way to work. You know, you just kind of move on as opposed to being too tied into sort of the recording process, which that Tascam was great, but it really limited you, and in some ways it made you better. But the digital workstation for me allows me to just sort of expand and explore and then pull it back and produce. And of course the fallacy is it allows you to overproduce, which I tend to do sometimes, but you know, it's always one of those things. It's liquid enough, you can pull it back. You know, you can add too much and then begin to cull it down.
Andy, from your perspective, as you got some of the tracks from Steve, what are some of the kind of the magic that you and Kerry Jackson brought to that equation on that song?
Steve, do you remember if what's on the final record are the vocals that you did on the demo, or did you do them over? Do you happen to recall?
I did them over then. I think what happened is I sent you guys all the tracks, and you began to peel off the tracks I had made in the rhythm section, live drums. I had programmed drums, I think. And you peeled those back and put in all your players down there, except I believe my vocals and my background vocals. And I don't know if you kept my rhythm guitar. I can't remember. And then you guys then sent me that track, those tracks kind of redone with a little more energy, frankly. And then I redid my vocals and background vocals on that. And we kind of passed them back and forth digitally. So it's a good process.
All right, that makes sense now. Yeah, because it's funny you had mentioned the Johnny Cash and the Everly Brothers, and then when Kerry and I were sitting down here getting it ready to send back to you, Kerry just instantly said Roy Orbison.
And said, yes, right.
See how all those are connected.
Yeah.
It's interesting. There's really nothing like working with other people. There's no way to emulate that or get the best of, bring the best out of yourself, really, I guess is one way of saying it.
Yeah.
And sometimes what other people hear and do puts your performance in a new light. Did you find yourself changing anything based on what you heard?
I think, like I said, I think there was a little bit more energy, because I think when I record sort of carefully, it gets very almost mechanical. And I think when I got it back from you guys, it was a little more live feeling. And so I think I changed my vocal style a little bit because the band had sort of this energy vibe of being live, and you kind of just take on that, like you want to kind of mirror that back. And so I think my vocals, and then I did backing vocals again, which didn't change much. But I think the lead got a little more amped up, I think. You get a little more excited about it, I think. And because the track sounded so good in your headphones, like, oh, my gosh, this is real, as opposed to me kind of noodling. So it's kind of a pleasant thing to see a song grow like that.
Yeah, that's how it's supposed to work. I'm glad it came out good. I'm able to listen to both the song and our conversation in the headphones right now at the same time. And I can really hear the quality vocal. And I just don't remember where that came into the process. It's good to know it came from something that you heard back from us. That's always how it's supposed to be.
Yes, right. Yeah, I think in essence, that's the downside of what I do a lot, which is basically in my little studio, which is just basically a little bedroom off the upstairs hallway. You know, you're all by yourself, and so the only energy you get is your own and the excitement of doing it, but there's no sort of that energy feedback loop that you get when you work with other people. So
yeah, great.
Well, Tom, is there anything else that you have, having been able to ask Steve a few questions, anything else you want to follow up?
One thing I was curious about is when you are recording in your studio, I don't know if you play bass, if you play drums, how are you getting those instruments incorporated into your songs that you record at your home studio?
Yeah, so I do play bass. Got much better at it actually in the last 10 years probably. I'm a keyboard. I would say I play keyboard, but I play it like a about a fourth grader. Like I'm almost single fingers. Mm-hmm. With MIDI, you can play and you can stop and you can, you know, it's a really simple process to sound like you know what you're doing in the digital world. So that helps me. I have a banjo, which I play adequately. I use the ukuleles that I have. I have a couple that sound like mandolins, and I will layer those on to make them sound that little chinky sound tuned up. And the drums I do almost, well, they always are because I don't have a drum set. I loved having Rex's drum set in my house for a year because I could actually keep a rhythm beyond that. I wasn't that much great, good, but I program all my drums.
What do you use?
Well, there's two ways I do it. I'll either in the digital recording workstation I have, I'll just map it out to create you can just do it digitally and say hi-hat, you know, kick. Mm-hmm. Or there's a program I will use called Band in a Box that I will actually write the whole song and do the entire arrangement in that program. And then you can strip out of it audio tracks of the drums that it creates. And you tell it where you want fills and when you want it to begin and end and such, and sort of the whole arrangement. And I can then pull that in. They're actually live recordings. How they do it, I don't know, but somehow it makes a really good drum track that has a lot of feel. And so I'll use that program to basically steal drums from, in essence, a program that I've written into. So that's how I get drums. And, that's kind of how I do it. And I think it's a little limiting because obviously I don't play something I've always wished was a violin or a fiddle because that can add so much to certain kinds of songs. And I can root around in other things like the keyboard and such, but it's all stringed instruments for the most part that I can play.
Rex was telling me you're playing quite a bit of jazz guitar now, which has such a completely different sensibility.
Yeah.
And a different set of techniques from rock guitar.
Right.
So how have you made that transition to playing jazz, and do you play jazz out say in a club, or do you play that at home? I'm curious.
So about 20 years ago or so, I think I've always been amazed by guitarists Pat Metheny, Joe Pass and such, that they can play the instrument kind of they're taking it as a kind of broader idea as opposed to just block chords or rhythm playing. They're almost seeing the fretboard like a keyboard and understanding it that way. And so I didn't understand what they were doing and started a study about 20 years ago on my own. Took some lessons from a guy here in Seattle, like six lessons. And then I've just been on my own. And then there is a school here that I actually, as an architect, helped design their spaces called Jazz Night School, and have taken classes there to get better. And in that, you play in context of a ensemble they put together for you. So we play out in a club for the performance, and you learn from working within the context of an ensemble, which is really a great way to learn.
Yeah, that must improve your technique and your sort of, and of course your interplay, not only live, but with recordings you're working on.
Right.
That's an interesting way to learn, and a way to, I think, improve technique in all string instruments.
Yeah, I think it's true. And jazz is one of those funny, musical styles that you are composing. Everyone in the group, in essence, is composing in the immediacy and in the moment. Even if you're just playing the rhythm behind someone, you're trying to improve the whole sound by improvising the rhythm section. And I find that for me just lit a bulb in my head. It's like, oh, that is really interesting. That you can do your great lead work out front, but to have the rest of the group also kind of improvising behind you and interplaying. And I just find that really interesting when people are composing in the moment And I think I've gotten better at it. I wouldn't say I'm a champion of it, but I enjoy it a lot. And so that's my big focus as of the last 10 or 15 years of mostly playing jazz. But I do like songwriting. And now that I've got into, digital recording, that has really opened up a passion for mine. Is just, I love the process. I mean, for me, I've got dozens of songs completed, but it's not like I'm out there selling them. It's more just the process. It's the same as my painting.
Maybe as we get ready to wrap up this interview, Steve, we can have you tell us a little bit about your first interaction with this thing called the vinyl record.
I hate to admit this, but my first record, my grandmother gave me $3 for birthday when I was, I think, 11. And I went to what would be the Forum, right? It was called French Market. It was kind of like Kmart or whatever. And I bought this record by Iron Butterfly called Metamorphosis. And I'm pretty sure the reason I bought it, because when you flip the album cover, is just, psychedelic. When you flip it over, there's a drawing of a naked girl on the back. I'm pretty sure as an 11-year-old, I went, whoa. And I bought that album. So that was my first album, was Metamorphosis by Iron Butterfly, which is kind of weird because it's not like I lived and breathed that kind of music. I'm pretty sure I was wrapped into the psychedelic look of it and such. So.
Well, Steve, we really thank you for taking the time. First of all, not only for doing this interview today, but also for all the work you did on Big Frizz Age 2. Yeah. We really appreciate your contribution. We enjoyed working with you, and it was really fun to see that song sort of bloom as we got it all developed between Phoenix, Scottsdale, and Seattle.
Yeah, great.
Andy Kern, is there any final question or comment you have for Steve about the recording process or the kind of, as you saw the files from your perspective, anything that kind of stood out to you?
No, just did a great job. It was easy to work with once I got them back and everything lined up. All the technical stuff was there.
Yeah.
So you're not only your chops are getting there, or they are there, and then your tech stuff too.
Yeah.
Really good. Really good.
Yeah, great.
All right. Well, I think we'll wrap this up. Thanks again, guys, and check out the Big Frizz Age 2 album. We'll end this segment with a little bit of the song She Said, He Said, co-written and played by and sung by Steve Sutherland. Thanks, guys.
All right.
But she said, you don't hear me anymore. And he said, we're always talking through closed doors. She said, I've lost the sacred way. Then he said, there must be something more to say. There's a frequency beyond the human ear, but not too faint for the human heart to hear. Bullets from a gun, but we never wait to see the damage that we've done.